Migration Conversations is a podcast that invites persons to share their migration stories. Hosted by myself, Professor Jamie Liu, each episode is an in-depth conversation with people who have experienced the Canadian immigration system or other migration regimes up close. We talk to migrants, immigrants, lawyers, policymakers, advocates, and experts. We hope that these conversations shed light on the challenges migrants face through their own voices. Welcome to a special episode of Migration Conversations. This is a recording from an event held by the University of Ottawa Public Law Center, hosted by Professor Vanessa McDonnell and myself. We are in conversation with Minister Ahmed Hussein, who has served as Minister of Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship, and now is Minister of Families, Children and Social Development. Our conversation traces his path as a law student, alumni from the University of Ottawa's Faculty of Law, to his position at the cabinet table in the federal government. I hope you enjoy this repeat of a presentation that was aired earlier this spring.
Good morning, everyone. Bonjour tout le monde. My name is Vanessa McDonnell, and I am co-director of the Ottawa Public Law Center. And it's my pleasure this morning to briefly introduce this session with the Honorable Minister Ahmed Hussein, Minister in the Federal Cabinet and an alumnus of the University of Ottawa. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that today I'm located on Algonquin territory, and to pay respect to the Algonquin people who are the traditional guardians of this land. This morning, our session will be moderated and led by Professor Jamie Liu. Jamie Liu is a colleague of mine, a member of the executive of the Public Law Center. She is an expert in citizenship, immigration, and statelessness. She is the co-author of a leading academic text on immigration law. And she is also a soon to be published fiction author, which is my favorite part of Jamie's bio. So without further ado, I will pass this on to Jamie, who will lead our session today. Professor Liu.
Thank you, Vanessa. That's very kind of yourself for that very warm welcome. Very delighted to welcome Minister Hussein, who is a graduate of our program here at the University of Ottawa, who has practiced criminal, immigration, and human rights law, co-founder of the Regent Park Community Council, and served as national president of the Canadian Somali Congress. He was elected in 2015 to represent the riding of York Southwestern. Minister Hussein has served as Minister of Immigration, Refugees, and Citizenship, and now as Minister of Families, Children and Social Development. Welcome back to our virtual photo hall, Minister.
Thank you so much for having me. Je suis heureux d'être ici aujourd'hui avec vous. It is such a pleasure to be here with all of you. c'est un grand plaisir pour moi de retourner dans mon école de droit. Bien aimé et d'avoir l'honneur de me connecter avec des étudiants. Je vous en suis reconnaissant. Je vais essayer de répondre à toutes vos questions et de prendre en compte vos commentaires sur ce que nous pouvons faire mieux au gouvernement. Merci.
Thank you, Minister. So I will just let attendees know that you can post some questions in the Q&A box in the Zoom webinar, but we have a conversation that we hope to have, and then I will provide some questions to you.
No problem.
So I first wanted to ask you, Minister, can you tell us a little bit about your decision to pursue a career in law? Many of our students are in law school, but how did that decision come to you?
So I have to point out that I didn't go to law school right after graduating from undergraduate studies. After graduation, I went to work in politics, in provincial politics, in the Ontario Legislative Assembly during the day. But on evenings and weekends, I had a second job, which was a voluntary job, but it was really a very serious job, which took a lot of my time, but I enjoyed it very much, which was being the founding president of the Regent Park Community Council. This was a position that was, in effect, the voice of an organization that represented 21,000 people. So Regent Park, for those who may not know, at the time was Canada's oldest and largest social housing neighborhood. Those buildings were built in 1948. And as I said, they housed 21,000 people, 65 different nationalities and ethnic groups. And essentially, I spent 7 years doing that. And for me, that was a really educational experience, because I got to see firsthand the power of community organizing and what can happen when communities come together, when people come together and demand change, and when people work consistently to improve the services around them, to improve their rights, to demand better, to be more involved. And it took us 8 weeks, 8 weekends in a row of meeting in a church basement to even set up this Regent Park Community Council, which became the official voice of these 21,000 people. But just to give you the students an idea of what we were dealing with, as I said, Regent Park was a place of 21,000 people. We did not have a single mailbox, a single mailbox. And yet, in the town of Wasaga Beach, which had about 21,000 people, they had 21 mailboxes. So two different places, same population of Canadians, one had a mailbox for each 1,000 people, and the other had none. So that's what we were dealing with. Imagine a place that doesn't have mailboxes. What else does it not have? We didn't have any community space. We didn't have any banks. We didn't have any services, essentially. And what led me to law really is, after doing 7 years of advocacy for the community, I got to see the importance of advocacy, the importance of being a voice for people, and the importance of fighting for human rights. And I saw lawyers who came into the community who helped us on certain issues. And I said, you know what? I'd love to get a law degree, because I think law would make me a better advocate. So I deliberately went to law knowing what I wanted to get out of it, which was to become a better advocate, to become a person who can organize the community better and who can fight on issues on behalf of and together with residents. So I knew what I wanted, but that also resulted in me going to law school after working for 5 years after undergraduate studies. So that's normally not what happens. People go straight to law school from undergrad. I didn't. I spent 5 years working, which helped me because I saved some money to pay for the expensive tuition.
Minister, that's a very heartening story to hear, that your lived experience and your advocacy work really informed your trajectory. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit about your choice in law school and the University of Ottawa prepared you. Yes,
that's right. So I deliberately chose Ottawa because I saw their motto, and their motto is social justice. I hope it still is. At the time it was. And I said, you know what? I want to go to Ottawa. I don't want to go to another law school where it's something else. But I want to go where the focus is on social justice, because that's what I was involved in for 7 years, and even prior to that and after that. And that's why I wanted to go to law school, to become a better advocate, to sharpen my skills, to get tools that I felt I didn't have to become a better advocate. So I felt, I looked around and I said, what law school would closely resemble what I'm looking for? And I said Ottawa. The second reason is because Ottawa U Law had a higher percentage of mature students than other law schools. And I felt, again, I would be a better fit because remember, I wasn't coming in as an undergraduate student straight out of undergrad. I had worked for 5 years for Dalton McGuinty, who at the time was first of all leader of the official opposition in Ontario, and then afterwards he became the premier. And he's also a graduate of Ottawa U Law, so it's kind of interesting. And I spoke to him as well, and he was very supportive of my decision to leave and pursue legal studies.
Fascinating. Minister, you spoke a lot about how your work and your advocacy has informed, you know, your path to law school. I wonder if you could speak to how that experience and also about your being a member of the Canadian Somali community has affected your work as a minister in your two portfolios that you've.
I would say, to be honest, I would say my Regent Park experience has informed me more because Regent Park was a microcosm of Canada. New immigrants to Toronto usually start off in Regent Park and then they move on. But we also had a lot of older residents. There were, as I said, 65 different ethnic groups in Regent Park. So I was representing that. And so I had a lot of experience doing that. And I was able to see firsthand that politics can be a force for good, that public service can make a difference if you are able to somehow bring people together. We were able to increase the voting average. We were able to improve community safety. We were able to create jobs. We were able to bring $500 million to Regent Park, which became $1 billion after, because we leveraged some land. We leveraged, for example, the Toronto Community Housing Corporation was spending millions of dollars maintaining those old buildings. And we said, well, if you revitalize, you can actually you can leverage those future savings to get investment now. When it reached $1 billion, we were able to go to the developers and say, look, you are going to be spending $1 billion here. We as residents strongly encourage you to carve out 150 million, 15% of the 1 billion for union jobs. And they agreed. Then we turned around and went to the union and said, we just got you a $150 million contract for jobs. So what we want from you in exchange is we want you to give the young men and women in Regent Park, who are mainly Black Canadians and other racialized Canadians, we said, we want you, the union, to give us in return jobs and apprenticeships to those young people. And through that, we were able to lift a lot of families out of poverty. Your question was, you know, so how did that help me? I mean, I got 7 years of real life education on how to get stuff done, on how to petition City Hall, on how to push Queen's Park, on how to push the federal government, on how to work with the police and make the police actually do community policing. Regent Park had 51 division. The Toronto Police Service had a branch in Regent Park. It was the only branch out of all the branches that had two distinctive features. One, the police in Regent Park consisted of two groups: new trainees who had no connection to the community, or people who were dumped there for disciplinary problems from other branches. So we didn't have a police department in our neighborhood that actually connected with the community. Everywhere else in Toronto had a police division that grew with the community. And so we went to kind of disrupt that and say, look, you have to come in and we have to work together. This is about community safety. It's not just about policing. And, you know, and I went through a lot of racial profiling by the police and so on. So did my friends. So we worked to resolve that. We brought UFT and York University to Regent Park. We created jobs for the older population. And the educational opportunities, we called it a learning exchange because there was a lot of new immigrants there who had internationally trained credentials. internationally trained professionals who lived in Regent Park. So they had a learning exchange with graduate students and professors from U of T and York University. The point I'm trying to make is when you have people organizing and consistently working to improve the community, things start to happen. And the word here, the key word here is consistent. It's easy to come out for a demonstration on a weekend. But if you keep it up for 16 weekends, then things start to move because the institutions will take you more seriously. And remember, I talked about improving the voting average from 29% to about 80%. Guess what? The politicians started taking us seriously because then they realized, wait a second, these people have woken up, now they're voting. So we should give them attention because we need their votes. And in exchange, we demanded them to also pay attention to us. So I think I learned a lot because prior to that experience, I associated politics with negative things. I didn't think politics could be a force for good. I didn't think public service was worth it. But after those 7 years, I can tell you, I mean, I didn't have a social life. I worked in the Ontario Legislative Assembly from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. And then evenings and weekends were taken up by Regent Park. So I did that for 7 years. But I don't regret it. I'm glad I had that experience because it served me so well now. Because I've brought that experience even before becoming a cabinet minister. I was an MP from 2015 to 2017. I was a backbench member of parliament. I loved it because I was able to bring again those lessons to parliament. How do you organize the community? How do you deliver for your community? How do you leverage things? So, for example, in 2016, as a backbench MP, I was able to take the Canada Summer Jobs allotment for my constituency of York Southwestern. Then I approached a foundation and I said, well, the government is going to create this many jobs for youth in my area. Can you match that money? And they did. So, you know, if you don't ask, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen? The institution or the person will say no, but they may say yes. But if you don't ask, you don't know, right? So Regent Park experience for me was monumental in enabling me to see the value of positive politics, the value of consensus politics, and the value of public service in and of itself. And last but not least, the value of community services. Remember the mailbox I was talking about? Libraries, transit, community gardens, community services like banking and laundry, and affordable housing. Those were the lessons I took. And in fact, my first campaign and subsequent has been about protecting those community services that I benefited from and expanding them for the future generation. And that's actually the reason I ran. I didn't want to run. I never thought that I would be a politician. But I ran because I felt that the community services that I benefited from, I printed my first resume at the community library. I didn't have a printer. But in 2015 and 2014, I noticed politicians making fun of community libraries and saying, oh, they're for the elites. No, they're not. Community libraries are crucial for community members. So I ran to protect those services. And the only reason I ran is I was complaining about all these cuts and attacks on the services. And my friend said, well, why don't you do something about it? And I said, well, I can't do anything. I'm one person. And I was happy practicing as a lawyer, and they said, well, no, but you could run. I said, no, I'm not going to run. That's too hard. I'm happy being a lawyer. And they just kept coming back to it and coming back to it. And finally, I accepted their challenge and ran.
That's a fascinating story. And I see a lot of work that you've done locally and the meaningful connections that you've had with your own community. And you did end up getting elected as obtaining a seat at the cabinet table, first as a Minister of Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit about how that transition was in terms of working locally in a grassroots kind of atmosphere, yeah, and then trying to bring your ideas to this very institutional and federal jurisdiction. And I wondered if you could also touch upon how you've been very open in your past about coming to Canada as a refugee, your work as an immigration lawyer, and how this might have informed the ideas, the approach you took in that portfolio as Minister of Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship?
Yes, actually, a couple of things there. It's a long question, so I'll try to unpack it. Number one, in 2015 when I was running, and 2014, I told my constituents, if you vote for me and if I get elected, whether you vote for me or not, I will be an MP first and foremost. And when I joined the cabinet, I kept that promise, and I still consider myself a member of parliament first and then a minister. What that means is that my constituents are first, their issues, their concerns, their aspirations. Second, in terms of bringing those views to parliament and to the cabinet table, it's very simple. I believe in a couple of things. Number one, we don't have all the answers in Ottawa. You have to listen to the people. And to do that, you have to engage them. So one of the things that I did after getting elected, and I continue to do that, I mean, COVID now has made it harder. I do it through other means, is I knock on doors between elections. Traditionally, what do people do? They vote, knock on doors in their constituency during the election, they get voted in, and then they don't knock on the door until the next election. I didn't do that. And that's something I promised my constituents that I will do. And I maintained that until COVID happened. And I couldn't do that anymore because of public health considerations. But I still do that virtually through Zoom meetings, but also through telephone conversations. And I do that because I want to hear what people have to say, what their concerns are. And unless you do that, you really don't know deep what the pulse of the community is. Let me give you an example. When I was first running in 2014, 2015, one of the most consistent things that I heard in the community was one issue, basement flooding. So people's basements were being flooded, not because their houses had leaky pipelines, but it was, so the houses were fine, but the street sewage system was very old. And those pipes were built in the 60s and so on. So when there would be a little bit more rain than usual, that water would back into the basements of people in certain neighborhoods. And so this is something that I personally heard at the door over and over again. I mean, I knocked on thousands and thousands of doors. And I said to people, I looked them in there and I said, look, I cannot promise 100% results, but I promise 100% effort. If I get elected, I will raise this issue. I did. So I raised it in 2015. I wasn't lucky to get it in the budget in 2016. I didn't get it in 2017 and 2018. I finally got it in 2019. And I was able to bring infrastructure dollars to fix basement flooding for one part of the neighborhood. Then I got reelected in 2019, and I discovered there was another part of the neighborhood that still had basement flooding. I went back to my government, and we were able to get funding this year to fix that. Now, there was no way I would have known the extent of that problem had I not knocked on each and every door of those residents who told me. So that's lesson number one. Lesson number two is, you know, getting elected to office is not a privilege. It's a trust. It's literally people trusting you to fulfill their hopes and dreams and be their strong voice in the future. So when you go to Ottawa, you have to remember it's not about you. It's about them. It's about Canadians. So you have to wake up every morning and say, how can I work hard today to make the lives of my constituents better? And I know it sounds like a cliche, but it truly is, for me, a monumental task. It's a trust. And for me, that trust is huge. It's in my shoulders. And I have to do whatever I can to live up to that trust. Because, you know, like, to be trusted with that kind of responsibility is not a joke. And therefore, you have to take it very seriously. The day you forget that it's about them, the day you think it's about you, is when you should stop being their representative. And so I wake up every morning with that concern. And the lesson that I got from Regent Park and my experience with the Canadian Somali Congress, and also my experience as a lawyer, quite frankly, is that you almost have a fiduciary responsibility to your constituents. You have to make time for them. You have to meet them. You have to listen to them. You have to work for everyone not just those who voted for you, you know? And you have to speak truth to power, even when, you know, your constituents' interests sometimes are against the prevailing mood in Ottawa. You have to, you're their voice. It's not about you. It's not about your feeling. And so, so that's what motivates me. And I think public service, as long as you have the right philosophy, meaning you know that it's not about you and that you push hard, things will start to happen. And in that sense, it's very rewarding. But I always remind myself that the job is not done. There's always more work to be done. Oh, and last but not least, as Minister of Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship, previous role, I can tell you, my goodness, the fact that I came to Canada as a 16-year-old refugee, the fact that I went through the process, good, bad, the fact that I experienced immigration backlogs was extremely helpful to me because I could approach that issue from a personal perspective and really attack those backlogs. And we were able to make a lot of changes to the refugee system, to the immigration processing system, and family reunification because I had that background. The second thing is now in my new role, I'm also the minister responsible for housing, affordable housing and homelessness. Again, I lived in very poor social housing, but it was still housing. It was better than being on the street. So when I approach affordable housing policy, I approach it from, again, very lived experience. And that, again, helps me to push harder than I guess I would normally do and try to be as ambitious as possible and push our government to do more and more.
Thank you, Minister. I just want to return to that portfolio for a second before we talk about your current mandate. Yeah. I mean, the minister in charge of immigration, refugees and citizenship, it is an enormous file.
Yes,
it and is. You had met with a lot of advocates and organizations and groups of people throughout your term as minister. And a lot of issues were raised during your term, some of which you enacted some changes and others in which might have been more difficult for you. I wondered if you could speak about the things that you were proud of and also the challenges. And you did do some work with regards to family reunification.
Yes.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the challenges that Canada has at its borders in terms of receiving refugees, the Safe Third Country Agreement, both your accomplishments and the challenges that you faced.
Well, one of the things that I'm most proud of, in addition to bringing my own personal experience to the role, I also made it a point to listen to the experts, to listen to legal experts like yourself. And I listened to their advice and I implemented a lot of the things that they were asking for. And by the way, just to make it clear, I implemented things that previous ministers of immigration were too wary of doing. For example, and for me, it was a question of not being courageous, but it was a question of just doing the right thing. I'll give you an example. Removing the designated countries of origin. This was a discriminatory policy that treated different asylum seekers, differently based on their countries of origin. Gave them different hearing dates and different levels of appeal based on their country of origin. I thought that was discriminatory. Everyone knew that it was, but a lot of ministers knew that as well prior to me. They came close to repealing it, but they didn't. And I felt that it was important to listen to the experts and out of basic fairness, we got rid of it. And despite the prevailing opinion that said that there'll be a huge backlash, there was no backlash. So that was one. The second thing that we did was remove conditional PR, which was harming a lot of women. You know that. This put a lot of women in very vulnerable situations. And I'm very proud that we removed conditional PR. We repealed the discriminatory bill that treated Canadian citizens differently based on those who are born in Canada versus those who are naturalized. We repealed Bill C-24, and once again ensured that a Canadian is a Canadian is a Canadian. We increased refugee and immigration levels more broadly every single year that I was in office in that role, we invested heavily in the refugee determination system. We brought back merit-based appointments process to appoint refugee judges and adjudicators and appeal court folks, and invested heavily in the system to speed up and clear backlogs. And you mentioned the border. I'm so proud that I was part of a government that did not demonize refugees, despite pressure. You know what we were facing south of us. You know the kind of opposition that we had that was really openly demonizing asylum seekers and those who are seeking sanctuary. I'm proud to have stood up in the House of Commons and outside of it to defend refugees, to defend the most vulnerable against shameless attacks from the opposite side, but also the context around the world that was hardening against those who were seeking protection. I'm so proud. And to be given that opportunity by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to be put in that position, I hope I lived up to it, but I'm proud that as a government collectively and as Minister of Immigration at the time, I stood up to those vicious attacks and that demonization. And you know, I'm proud that we were there. I can't even think what would happen if we were not there and the Conservatives were there. I don't know what would have happened, but I'm proud that we stood up for Canadian law, but we also stood up for international, we stood up for the Geneva Convention and the international commitment that Canada made with respect to non-refoulement of asylum seekers, with respect to making sure that everyone had a right to a refugee hearing and a quick process. And, you know, I'm proud to have defended that process.
Minister, you're right that we should be proud that we have one of the best refugee determination systems in the world. Yes. And I commend you for your public service in tweaking and continually reforming that. I wondered if I could just indulge you a little bit and ask, are there things yep. that you wish you could have done before your time was up? And I know it's not always the choice of the minister when your time is up or when your mandate ends. And I wondered if there were things maybe like the Safe Third Country Agreement. I was very heartened about your pilot program on Regulation 11790, and I want to applaud you for that.
Yeah,
and there all are a the few things that you mentioned. But yeah, if you could talk about a few things.
I mean, I started a pilot program for undocumented people to gain a pathway to citizenship. I just wish we did more of that. And I wish that I was able to, first of all, let me start off by saying I got a lot done and there's not a lot that I ran time out of. Like there's not a lot of issues that I can think of that I didn't get to, except a few. One is undocumented folks. I think we need to do more there. And also just the temporary foreign workers, not all of them, but some would love to remain in Canada and become members of our community. They already are. And again, so expanding those pathways and creating more spaces, I think that's one place I would have loved to do more. A little bit more deeper work on speeding up the refugee determination process. I had started a pilot program in Montreal to do determinations in three months. It was a pilot program. And I wanted to test it out and then expand it to the entire system, but I didn't get a chance to finish that work. So a few things like that, and then the other thing that I had done was export Canada's privately sponsored refugee model to a dozen countries, and I wanted to continue that because I thought that was a really good way for Canada to increase settlement spaces in a bigger way with many other countries, and also just export that model of welcoming refugees to local communities. And I found, by the way, I found a lot of enthusiasm for that program, even in countries that were officially hardening their position against asylum seekers. They were very welcoming of the privately sponsored refugee model, which for me was an opening. So I used that and I traveled to a lot of these countries and I personally lobbied those governments to give this program a chance. And they did. And that didn't make the news, but a lot of them would surprise you. Like they actually took the time to implement these programs. Like Brazil is a good example, Argentina, the UK, New Zealand, Australia, the Netherlands, Belgium.
Yeah, it's amazing to see how this portfolio really is not just a domestic one, but it also has international reach as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We did a lot of work to, for example, build consensus among refugee receiving regions in the world to get a win-win situation, because there's always a danger that local communities would turn on refugees when refugees get services and they don't. And so I was working on that. There's a lot of crossover between international development and refugee policy. And we did a lot of work there too. Again, a lot of this didn't make the news, but it was very, very important. And I think Canada led very, very effectively in those spaces and at the United Nations as well.
Yeah. I have so many more questions I could ask you about your time in this portfolio, and maybe one day we can revisit that. But permit me now if we can shift to your current role. Pouvez-vous nous décrire les priorités principales en tant que ministre de la famille, des enfants et du développement social?
Yeah, my priorities really now are on housing. The National Housing Strategy has expanded. It was a $40 billion program. Now it's a $70 billion program, which aims to ensure that each and every Canadian has a safe and affordable place to call home. The other one is early learning and childcare, making sure that we implement a national system of early learning and childcare. And also encourage the social enterprises and social development, social enterprises and social purpose organizations across the country.
Yeah, those are quite a big area of things to work on. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit about challenges in the pandemic. De quelle manière la pandémie a-t-elle eu un impact particulier sur les enfants?
Yes, I would say that, you know, the pandemic has made things difficult. Avec la deuxième vague de cette pandémie encore, nous avons besoin de plus de logements abordables et nous en avons besoin maintenant. It has created challenges, especially when it comes to vulnerable populations. And, you know, nous savons que chaque Canadien mérite un chez-soi sous et abordable, mais beaucoup trop d'entre eux doivent faire un choix impossible entre payer leur loyer et nourrir leur famille. We know that every Canadian deserves a safe and affordable place to call home. Every Canadian would agree with that statement, but many, many people are still forced to make the impossible choice between paying rent and buying groceries. And the second one is on early learning and childcare. You know, many, many parents with children, especially women, are held back from working and moving, you know, being more economically well off as a result of not having access to affordable childcare. This is a real, real crisis in our country, and our government wants to embark on a journey with provinces and territories to finally implement a national system of sustained investments in affordable, accessible, and quality childcare, and inclusive childcare from coast to coast to coast.
I want to revisit the focus on childcare, because as you know, childcare has been a challenge for many people during the pandemic, for example, and women having to leave the workforce to do childcare. And I wondered, has your ministry looked at initiatives or mechanisms by which we can pull people back into the workplace, assist people who need childcare coming out of the pandemic? What are the kinds of things that your government's thinking about as we move towards and hopefully soon the end of the pandemic?
La pandémie a rapidement affecté le secteur de la garde d'enfants. It has, the pandemic has affected the childcare sector really, really strongly. And, you know, a number of things that we've done to deal with that. Number one, we've moved very quickly to, as a government, to provide support to the childcare sector, because this sector was heavily, heavily affected by the pandemic. Making sure that those spaces remain open, making sure that we preserve the affordable childcare spaces that we've been able to create, the additional spaces since 2015. In addition to that, providing a little bit more support for families with children through the Canada Child Benefit. On May 20th, 2020, we provided a one-time increase of up to $300 per child for each child receiving the Canada Child Benefit. And then on July 20th, we increased the Canada Child Benefit permanently once again. And this year, we've promised to have an increase of up to $1,200 per child for families who have children under the age of six who are already receiving the Canada Child Benefit. Secondly, we are investing in the workforce for early childhood educators to make sure that the sector is supported. And we are also renewing agreements, bilateral agreements between Canada and the provinces and territories to support the sector to create more affordable spaces. And lastly, we need to, again, work together with provinces and territories to embark on a system of early learning and childcare that's truly affordable. It's time to do this. And by the way, it is crucial for the economic recovery after the pandemic to build an affordable childcare system once and for all, so that every child in Canada has access to affordable childcare.
Thank you, Minister. I note that there's quite a few questions coming through, so I thought we could move to answering some questions that may be coming from attendees. And the first here is, many newcomers still have various difficulties to have access to well-paying jobs that resonate with their work and education background gained in their home countries, and they get stuck with poor career decisions for their lifetime. How do you scale the learning exchange you designate at Regent Park to provide equal consideration and respect to international training and to work experience of immigrants?
That's a very good question. I would say that, you know, in terms of what we like, the issue of credentials recognition obviously is under the jurisdiction of the provinces. However, we felt in our government that we should do whatever we can to enable Canada to benefit from the experiences and the skills of professional newcomers. And so our government introduced a program called the Targeted Employment Strategy for Newcomers to enable them to make the bridge and make the transition between their regular job and jobs in their field by providing them with income supports during their time for that they're going through the licensing process in Canada, providing them with soft loans in order to be able to pay for the exams and the books, and also income support while they're studying for the exams. A lot of newcomers, professional newcomers, even when the licensing process is clear, have difficulties overcoming those invisible barriers. And finally, even when they become licensed, it becomes an issue with Canadian experience. So part of the targeted employment strategy for professional newcomers was about providing financial support to employers so that they can take a chance on professional newcomers. So it's a very successful strategy. But again, on the strict licensing issue, it's truly a provincial issue. And I would say the provinces obviously have to do their part as well.
Yeah, it's complicated when you are recruiting highly skilled migrants, and sometimes they come as skilled migrants, and the intersection of the jurisdictions is difficult to manage sometimes. Another question here, you speak so passionately about your community organizing and social innovation work in Regent Park. Your government has an opportunity to empower social innovation to help communities across Canada build back better. How do you see the role of a federal social innovation agenda in our recovery?
And if you don't mind, so I'll answer that question. And then can I also talk about my priorities in this new portfolio? Because I don't think I went into enough detail there. But for social innovation, social financing, other people call them social purpose organizations. It's really important for us to support this sector. I'll give you examples. There's a group in Winnipeg called Mother Earth Recycling. So what they do is they take mattresses and electronics, televisions and other electronic goods, and they recycle them. They refurbish them first, and then they recycle them. And in the process, they also, not only are they, do they do good work for the environment, but they also generate money. And they hire between 36 to 48 people at any given time. So they're helping the environment. And the people that they target for employment tend to be people who are either homeless or people who have been out of work for years, who are hard to employ and so on. And they give these people a chance. And they generate revenue and they generate business activity that generates revenue that they then put back into their social work. So these are organizations that are taking a business approach, but tackling complex social problems. The second one is an organization in London, Ontario, that set up a coffee shop, uses the profits from the coffee shop to set up affordable housing for homeless youth. And they've done an amazing job doing that. So we want to encourage that sector first to increase the capacity of these social enterprises, but to also increase the size of the ecosystem. So the Government of Canada set up the Social Finance Fund, a $755 million fund, and to get social enterprises ready for that fund, we created the Investment Readiness Program to increase the capacity of those organizations to be ready for the Social Finance Fund. But already because of COVID, we are hearing from the sector that they need even more investments. And so that's something that I've heard very clearly. In terms of my priorities, I think I had difficulty hearing you the first time. So I will try to answer a little bit in more detail if you can allow me. Notre gouvernement reconnaît que chaque Canadien mérite un chez-soi sûr, abordable et accessible. Depuis 2015, nous avons accordé près de 13 milliards de dollars en logements dans tous les pays pour soutenir plus d'un million de Canadiens en matière de logement. Grâce à la toute première stratégie nationale sur le logement du Canada, nous fournirons au secteur plus de 70 milliards de dollars en financement stable et à long terme. Nous reconnaissons qu'il reste encore beaucoup à faire, mais grâce à la stratégie nationale sur le logement, nous veillons à ce que le gouvernement fédéral joue son rôle de partenaire à part entière en offrant à plus de Canadiens un chez-soi abordable. Notre gouvernement comprend aussi qu'investir dans nos enfants signifie investir dans notre avenir. Nous allons investir plus de 7 milliards de dollars pour l'apprentissage et la garde de jeunes enfants dans la prochaine décennie. Depuis 2015, nous avons déjà créé près de 40 000 places en garde à travers le Canada. So, we'll continue that work as over $7.5 billion dedicated to early learning and childcare, creation of more affordable childcare spaces. The National Housing Strategy, you've seen the new Rapid Housing Initiative, is doing great work to create housing rapidly in response to COVID-19 challenges that have worsened housing challenges for the most vulnerable. So those are the priorities that I have in this new portfolio. And as I said, one of the things that I value very much from this job is listening to Canadians and having the opportunity to come back to Ottawa physically or virtually to implement and fight for the changes that Canadians are asking us to do to help them not only through the pandemic but in the recovery after the pandemic.
Thank you, Minister. I have a question here from Kahin Ismail. He's also a Somali Canadian and a proud alumni of our University of Ottawa Faculty of Law. He works for the UN Refugee Agency as head of regional operation in East Africa. And he was interested in hearing your views on Canada's position on refugee solidarity in general. He noted that you were very active in refugee resettlement.
Canada has been a very strong partner of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. We stood firmly at the United Nations for refugee rights and the responsibility to share in the protection of refugees around the world. We signed the UN Compact on Migration, which again sought to collaborate on all issues related to immigration, including refugees. And we partnered with a number of countries to make sure that those who had expressed solidarity with refugees, those who had welcomed refugees at great cost to their national budgets and environment, countries like Jordan, countries like Kenya, Lebanon, Turkey, that we stood with those countries and that we stood in solidarity, not just with the refugees, but also with the host communities. It's very important that we continue to do that. And I think Canada, and we've also financially supported every single year, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, including supporting them to fill the gaps that were created by the budget cuts and the funding cuts by the United States against the UNHCR.
Thank you, Minister. I have a question here from a budding lawyer. If you could give advice for a new junior lawyer practicing immigration law, what would that be?
I would say, you know, listen to your clients, interview them thoroughly, and you know, if you don't speak their language, of course, get an interpreter, but really try to ask probing questions and try to understand their perspective, especially, you know, for refugee clients. Really try to get to the bottom of their displacement and their journey so that you can be able to tell their story and be an effective advocate at the Immigration Refugee Board.
Minister, I have to say it is an honor to meet you. I want to thank you so much for giving your time to speak to us and coming back to FOTA with us. But most of all, I want to thank you for your public service and for sharing your inspiring story of how a refugee who's come to Canada as a teenager has really made it so far and share your experience and your hard work in relation to your trajectory, your path, and advice that you have for those of us working in this area. So thank you so much. And thank you to our attendees for those wonderful questions.
I would say, you know, I think my life story and my journey is more of an indication of what Canada is. Of course, we're not a perfect country. We have a lot of challenges, but I always say that my story is only possible in a country like Canada. My story is not possible anywhere else. And so I think my journey is more of an expression of the generosity and the welcoming of refugees by Canadians. And this is something that I continue to see now. I continue to see that, but I also saw it very vividly and repeatedly as Minister of Immigration, that Canadians from coast to coast to coast open their doors and open their hearts to refugees. And you know, I think part of it is also because we have the frameworks to do that. This is, you know, for 40 years, I mean, we started exporting that model recently, but for 40 years, Canada was the only country in the world where five private citizens could get together and sponsor a refugee or a refugee family. Nowhere else could you do that. So I think human beings are generous everywhere else, but Canadians had that opportunity through an institutional framework to say, okay, let's sponsor a refugee privately. Other people couldn't do that. Now more and more countries have taken up that model. But as I said, you know, my story is more of a story about Canada and about this country and its people's generosity and embrace of others and welcome, and the ability to also work together. There's so many people that I've worked together and continue to work together over the years that have really taught me the importance of public service, the importance of a legal education, the importance of remaining true to your principles, but also the importance of listening. I think a lot of times we think we have all the answers, but we don't. And it's important to listen to people with lived experience who can really guide us on the reality on the ground, because sometimes the solutions that they will pass on to you will be more effective and efficient and even less costly than programs that are made behind closed doors in the back rooms.
That's a wonderful note to add on and very inspirational. So thank you again for your time and for your words of wisdom.
Well, thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be back virtually in law school. And I really want to thank the University of Ottawa Law School and you personally, Professor, and all the students for giving me this opportunity to connect with you. Merci beaucoup, tout le monde.
Thank you. As a final note, I want to thank the Center for Public Law for hosting this event and also to Minister Hussein's team for coordinating with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Migration Conversations is created and hosted by me, Professor Jamie Liu, and produced by University of Ottawa Tech Law Fellow June Gleed. This podcast was made possible with the guidance and assistance of University of Ottawa Tech Law Fellow Ritesh Kotak, Carleton University graduate student Rachel McNally, as well as the generous support of Carleton University and the University of Ottawa Shared Online Projects Initiatives. You can find more Migration Conversations episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and YouTube with closed captions. Thank you for listening, and a special thank you for all the guests who have shared their experiences publicly.